You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of December 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I guess it's very simple when you think you haven't heard this expression, but we are making America great again. You haven't heard that, have you?
US President Donald Trump gloats over his tax bill victory, but did he gloat that little bit too much? My guests Joy Lodico and James Boyes will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including today's vehicle attack in Melbourne and the large-scale leaping to conclusions that ensued, the removal from their plinths of statues of two more American traitors, and the prospect that in Sweden a large straw goat might defy the odds and survive until Christmas. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Joy Lodico, columnist at the London Evening Standard, and James Boyes, political historian specialising in the United States and its place in the world. Welcome both. First of all, it has taken him the thick end of an entire year, but US President Donald Trump can now claim an actual legislative achievement. Although the degree to which the rewrite of the US tax code is an achievement, and the degree to which it is a mildly larcenous exercise in trickle-up economics, likeliest to benefit people who, to pick a random example, run property empires named after themselves, is the subject of spirited debate. As ever, however, Trump was unable to resist gloating and cheerfully informed reporters that the sales pitch of a middle-class tax cut may have been something of an economy with the truth. James, first of all, what basically has President Trump admitted?
Well, he's managed to get a major piece of legislation through both houses of Congress, and he can now say, frankly, he has achieved something. The extent to which it's going to benefit many people in the United States of a lower to middle income is very debatable. Quite clearly, what has happened here is there's going to be a huge tax cut for businesses in particular. The corporate rate tax is going to help massively benefit Donald Trump, as well as many, many people in that kind of tax bracket. But what you're seeing, I think, is an extent to which, you know, you've seen this supposedly populist president come to office pledging to make America great again for middle-class Americans and give a middle-class tax cut. And it's nothing of the sort. I mean, it's a complete fudge, quite frankly. I mean, it's, I don't like to use the outright lie, but it clearly was. And it's a work to gem because, again, you've got this piece of legislation getting through with no support from the Democratic Party. And people like Paul Ryan, you know, it's suddenly Christmas.
He kind of said so, though, didn't he, Joy? He sort of admitted now that it's gone through that it was mostly about the corporate tax cut and all this stuff about, you know, cutting some slack for middle-class families was just the sort of thing you have to say to get it through. He really can't help himself is his problem.
He can't help himself. I mean, the difference is something like, it's like a $900 tax cut for middle-class families and it's a $51,000 tax cut for anybody in the top 1%. But you've got to bear in mind the history of Trump and the tax man. He absolutely hates the tax man. He's the one who's had to deal with multiple companies trying to push money left, right and centre, dealing with bankruptcies, wouldn't release his tax returns because, I mean, frankly, the journalists would have pored over them and God knows what they would have found. And so this, in his own little way, is his victory over the tax man.
It does raise the question, that observation, of the extent to which Trump is animated more than anything else by his various petty grudges against those who have slighted him on his journey thus far. I don't think it's a coincidence, for example, when you look at his continual picking on the NFL, that he tried and failed himself to become an NFL owner at one point. But we did see, James, another one of these curious set pieces in which, you know, his cabinet are arrayed around a table and invited to tell him how marvellous he is for the benefit of passing cameras. I mean, you know, as a historian of the US presidency and so forth, on a scale of, say, 1 to Idi Amin, how weird are these?
They're very unusual. I could have
Unusual's doing a lot of work there, James.
I'm trying. It's my British understatement coming through. There's no doubt about it that the idea that you will have these set pieces, and this isn't the first, let's be honest.
No,
there was
it's
one
not.
Very, very soon after he came to power, now being led in a prayer session by the vice president, praying for the president himself. It's very, very odd. So you might be aware of the work of my friend Brian Klass, for example, does a lot of work on this idea of despotism creeping into the United States. And I think you can see with Donald Trump, this idea that it's not enough that he's president. He has to be deified almost. You know, one is reminded of Nixon with his insecurity, Lyndon Johnson with his inferiority complexes. But this is taking it to a whole new level, I think.
Joy, this is a victory for the Republicans. This tax bill they've been, you know, very keen on for a very long time. You could almost see Paul Ryan breaking the gavel with the exuberance which he brought it crashing down upon whatever it is you bring a gavel crashing down on. But why are the GOP so, I mean, apart from the fact that it makes them all lots of money, isn't it a bit politically weird of them to have invested so much in a bill which, as of current polling, has a 33% approval rating?
And I think the disapproval rating is well over 50% for it. Should they invest in it? Well, yeah, they're red-blooded Republicans. They promise tax cuts. Trump promised a tax cut in his manifesto. It is how he gets a series of votes. I think there's another side to that question, which is what they then cut in order to actually try and balance the books at the end of it. And that's where you begin to get a split in the Republicans between the kind of Paul Ryan types who would like to see everything slashed. I mean, they're already talking, there's already the budget director talking about cutting loads of programs as an act of compassion. And then you get the sort of, you know, the Bannonite wing, or, you know, the Bannon influence, in fact, the Social Democratic influence, who understand that you can't start talking about cutting it's Medicaid, Social Security. And Trump himself has said those are the two things he will not cut. They're completely ring-fenced at the moment. That's when the really interesting debate begins to happen within the Republicans.
James, there is a theory that you will have heard that the Republicans don't really much like Donald Trump themselves, and they have been kind of holding their noses until they got this deal done, and that once he had ceased to be useful to them, he might be summoned to a meeting at which he noticed that they'd put plastic on the floor for some reason. Is that a plausible theory? Are they likely to ditch him?
Well, I think that the idea that they would just launch a soft coup against him, it would be obviously unprecedented. And at this point, there'd be no need to. Funnily enough, I get asked a lot about this and how you could get Donald Trump out of office. The Republican Party are actually the best route to that. One of the things I do in my research is talk about how and why is that sitting presidents don't get a second term. And that only happens, from my analysis, when they have to fight a rearguard action for their own party's nomination. So for those of you out there who desperately want Donald Trump to be forced out of office, start writing to Republican members of Congress and say, you've got to start running against Trump now. So someone like Senator Flake, for example, who is stepping down from his seat in Arizona in 2018, could very well be nicely positioned to run against Donald Trump, undermine him sufficiently in the polls, and allow any Democrat, quite frankly, to come through and win in 2020.
President Trump to President Flake would, of course, just basically mean that history was now being written by Tom Wolfe. I mean, the nominative determinism's getting a bit...
I'm not suggesting that he would win, but I'm suggesting it would split the vote on the right and allow for an unnamed Democrat at this point to win. That's basically what happened in 1992, for example, in 1980 and 76, for example.
Okay, well, let's now move on and make the undemanding leap from Donald Trump to hysterical, ill-informed yahoos spouting specious inflammatory nonsense on social media. In Melbourne today, 14 people were injured, several of them critically, by a man who drove a car deliberately into pedestrian on Flinders Street. A dreadful crime, to be sure. However, large numbers of people chose to lurch to a conclusion which, while possibly understandable on recent form, turned out to be wrong. Victorian police said that the suspect, an Australian of Afghan descent, had a history of mental illness and drug use, but no links at all to terrorism so far as they could figure thus far. Joy, it's always a vexing spectacle, I think, to actual journalists when something like this happens. Social media does what it will do. People make the assumptions that they made. How damaging actually is it, or in terms of journalists actually trying to figure out what happened, much more importantly, police trying to find out what happened, and the discourse generally?
Well, I would hope journalists and police were not relying that much on social media in order to find out their facts. You'd hope they'd actually turn up on the ground and ask a few proper questions. sorry, excuse me. Does it matter? So social media is very helpful in these situations at a certain level because you distribute information incredibly fast, which says, get away from the scene. Mm. There's a problem here. Social media also causes total chaos. We had a similar incident in Oxford. Mm. Well, we had an incident in Oxford Circus where essentially the whole of central London shut down. And it turned out there was two guys having a brawl at the station, and the information passed too fast, moved too fast, and kind of caused hysteria. What do you do? How do you contain the information? I'm not sure you can, other than getting things like the police regularly into people's Twitter streams, constantly saying, calm down, everybody, calm down. This is, you know, not the disaster it seems.
That usually takes time, though, James. The weird thing is that it's not the first time it's happened, and I'm sure it won't be the last. People saw the images from Melbourne, distressing and dreadful though they were. They saw the fact that the police appeared to have apprehended at least one suspect of, you know, what I think you can reasonably call Middle Eastern appearance, and people then just picked it up and ran with it. But it strikes me that there's an element of the social media peanut gallery that actually revels in the idea that it might be terrorism. People seem to be actually quite enjoying distributing increasingly inflammatory reports of what it turned out hadn't actually happened.
Yeah, and I think what you're seeing is an extension of problems we've seen with the mainstream media, a horrible term, I know, and in terms of the desire to be fast, trumping the desire to be right. And that has become something which I think we've seen far too often. Think about how often we see incorrect stories about people who've died, for example, you know, and the idea that that takes hold very, very quickly, and the idea that people want to be seen to be at the cutting edge and saying, look, I got this out first, effectively. And I think that's certainly something which is making life on something like Twitter, for example, very, very difficult, because it's getting to a point where it's like, well, what is, you know, are facts facts at this point? And I'm certainly not trying to stray into Donald Trump's fake news area, but the idea that it's becoming very difficult sometimes to know exactly what it is that's factual when you're seeing so many people trying to be first with a story rather than trying to be right with a story. I think that's bad enough when you're a journalist, I think, but when that's compounded and the waters are muddied by, you know, just anybody out there with a phone, for example, trying to take imagery and, you know, get things up online so much, I think it becomes very, very difficult for everybody.
Is there any point, George? I mean, you mentioned the fact that the police, and I think they are getting better at it, of getting involved early on social media and trying to say to people, you know, this is what we actually know to be the case so far. But the kind of people who get wound up or enjoy getting wound up about these things are never satisfied with that explanation. I've seen it a lot sort of watching this unfold today. The police saying, we know who this guy is. He has a history of mental illness and drug use. He is not a terrorist. There is no connection to terrorism. And people are now just saying, we don't believe you. We have decided to believe what we would prefer to.
Okay, so I follow a couple of people on Twitter called Old Hoburn and this guy called Paul Joseph Watson, who works for InfoWars. And every time there's an incident
Prison
like
Planet.
This, Prison Planet. Every time there's an incident like this, almost like clockwork, he comes in and goes, the police are saying this, but have you looked at this chap's beard? Really? And he's from Afghanistan. Really? And it's actually hilarious after a while, because you begin to understand those in themselves as kind of trope of that particular style of media. And he's sitting there racking up massive hits on his YouTube channel, on Twitter. There's this constant thing about saying, oh, the mainstream media is lying to you. If you want to define the mainstream media today, I would say the mainstream media is actually the Twitterati with huge followings and YouTubers, and the fact that there's this sort of smaller, old-fashioned, more sluggish media that still does its homework. I'd object to the idea that we get stories wrong frequently.
No, I wasn't suggesting that, sorry.
But we aren't, you know, we don't own the news agenda anymore.
You think like actual proper news has become sort of a niche, arcane niche interest, like jazz.
Yeah, it's kind of. I mean, you basically, you know, you hear the pop music for Twitter, and then in the morning you may possibly just open up a real newspaper.
I mean, James, is it just that people need to be better educated about how the media actually works and how the law works as well? Because the thing that vexes me as somebody with, you know, pretensions to being an actual journalist is when things start happening and you just get all these people going, why isn't the BBC reporting this? To which you can only reply, because the BBC wants to be sure what's actually happened before it reports on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, just reiterate, I certainly wasn't suggesting that the media get it wrong all the time. Actually, I was more thinking back to when elections are called, for example, in Florida in 2000, and that was a problem because they were trying to get it too quick. With the online presence, I think, when you have, let's be honest about it, when you see something on a computer screen, a lot of people are more inclined to believe it. And if you see the BBC Twitter feed alongside a whole series of other people that you have chosen to follow because they tap into your own mental capacity and philosophy, then you know, it becomes an echo chamber effectively, and you start to think, well, okay, if I'm following this person because I believe them and they're saying X and the BBC isn't, I don't think most people perhaps realise the sort of the reporting restrictions and the necessity to get stories right than to get them fast for, you know, respected journalists. You know, and we've seen, you know, journalists lose their careers over this. I mean, the whole thing with Dan Rather, for example, back in, you know, the 2004, I think it was, when, you know, he reported what he believed were factual accounts of George W. Bush's times in the Texas Air Guard that were completely fatuous. So, you know, it's very, very troubling, I think, in this day and age when you're getting serious, respected journalists who have had to play by the rules and get it right every time when they're going up against people like Alex Jones and InfoWars, for example, and they can just basically spin this any which way they want. And when they're wrong, just like walk away from it and with a shrug.
Much like a certain US president we could name. Joy, Twitter did start this week taking a harder line on extremists, deleting tweets, cancelling accounts, suspending accounts. Is there an argument for them taking a... I'm not sure what the practicalities of this would be, but hey, I'm just an ideas guy. Does it need, when a story is breaking, to take a harder line on what voices are permitted to be heard? If it's fairly clear that somebody is just not actually contributing anything but inflammatory nonsense.
That's kind of an interesting idea. The thing is, even taking, I mean, it's taking people from Britain First offline here. Twitter is kind of founded on a sort of libertarian philosophy, as is most of California, which is about allowing everybody to speak. And in theory, it's the wisdom of the crowds that actually causes the retweets about things that are correct. What you're kind of working out is that the crowd is, in fact, a rather stupid crowd and will go and follow completely the wrong thing time and time again. I can't see how Twitter can police that without then itself coming under exactly the same charges the BBC comes under, which is that it's trying to restrict information. I think, in a sense, you have to let Twitter be Twitter, and you have to have different kind of pinnacles of factual correctness, such as the BBC, the Times, the New York Times, and so forth.
Okay, well, on that encomium to the jazz age of the media, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Millett, Joy Ladiko, and James Boyce. Coming up next, the United States population of Confederate statues reduces by two more.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
You're back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Miller, still with me, R. Joy Lodico and James Boyes. And let us return to the United States, specifically to Memphis, where at the very real risk of reigniting a public debate of sensational inanity, even by recent standards, two more statues of Confederate leaders have been dismounted from their plinths. Following the sale of two city parks to a private entity, crews began removing monuments to Jefferson Davis, the first and last president of the Confederate States of America, and Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate cavalry commander who, after the Civil War, was an early leader of the Ku Klux Klan. Joy, this is quite an amusing fiddle that the city of Memphis has pulled here. They did want to remove the statues. The state of Tennessee told them they couldn't, so they sold the parks to a private company which could.
I think they even changed the legislation, and then there was no stipulation as to what price they went for. So these, you know, bits of prime kind of green park went for $1,000 each.
A remarkable bargain.
To a company that had formed 2 or 3 months previously that had a stated intention.
James, the many questions always prompted by this are focused particularly in this case. The obvious question being, why would you build a statue to people who had served a traitorous and dreadful cause in the first place? But even if you think people can make an argument for perhaps the likes of Jeff Davis or General Robert E. Lee, Nathan Forrest, how do you end up putting up a... you know who Nathan Forrest was.
I do.
How do you build a statue of him in the first place?
Are you trying to ask me to justify that?
No, I'm not suggesting that you were in any way personally responsible.
Thank you very much. just to clarify this. I think that... You know, it comes down to the idea of that there is a certain Southern tradition, and what he was doing was tapping into that. And you remember, these statues weren't being built any time recently. They're going back a long, 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 long time, and it's quite right and proper that they are being taken down. Again, the valid question is, what were they being built in the first place? When you've got someone who's basically, you know, the leader of the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, for those of you who aren't familiar with who this guy is, this is the guy, if you've seen Forrest Gump, who's believed that Forrest Gump was christened after, if you've seen the movie. There's no doubt that these things should have come down. It's just surprising, frankly, they're taking this long to come down and are coming down at this time in this place, considering the what most people would think of as a rightward drift of the country under the presidency of Donald Trump.
Joy, this argument went kind of global, and there are variations of it everywhere in the world. In Britain, I guess most prominently, there's been arguments about statues of Cecil Rhodes. There's been arguments about the statue of Air Marshal Harris, and so forth. Is the problem that basically there isn't a hard and fast set of rules that you can just apply to all such cases, which means there's going to be a row about literally every single one?
Well, it's quite. I mean, a statue is sort of serving its purpose if. And society is serving its purpose if you can look at each one and have a row about it and be, you know, apply a little bit of kind of critical thought to it. I mean, the Cecil Rhodes statue, the obit for him in The Guardian, said he did more than any Englishman of his time to lower the reputation of the empire, and yet the statue still stands there. But he also gave a huge amount of money to the college. Now, I think the Rhodes Must Fall team, in fact, had a very valid point as to why have you left this guy up here? Isn't it time that we sort of change our values and so forth? And they put it to the Oxford academics, and the Oxford academics, you know, argued back and said, no, he's incredibly important to our college and so forth. If you're a society that can't have an argument about who it worships on the statues and puts on its plinths, you're basically cast in stone already. You are inflexible.
James, how do you account for the blind spot that sections of the United States do still have about the figures of the Confederacy? I mean, they were by any sensible standards, they were traitors to the United States.
Because they don't see themselves as citizens of the United States. This is still something which is going on.
But the people who defend the statues will always talk about themselves as proud Americans.
Yeah, but they'll also suggest that they were citizens of the Confederacy. I mean, there's a reason that the stars and bars were still flying from state houses. Nikki Haley, I think, for example, was very responsible for getting some of that removed, which we should give her credit for, I think. But this idea that you can still be flying the flag of a rebellion, effectively, in the 21st century is quite frankly remarkable. I mean, my favourite story about fallen statues, it must be said, if you've seen the opening credits to GoldenEye, the James Bond movie, which takes part in the post-Cold War, the Russian government were absolutely horrified and complained the fact that, of all the things you complain about in a Bond film, the fact that the opening credit sequence had these fallen icons, Lenin and Stalin, and their biggest objection was the fact that they were being smashed to smithereens by rather attractive young ladies in bikinis, which was seen to be the ultimate expression of disdain for the Soviet Union, I guess.
I mean, with these statues and with other statues of this ilk, Joy, what should be done with them? Should they be dismantled, if necessary, by bikini-clad women with hammers, or should they be interred in museums, or as they have in Budapest, as they've done with all the communist statues there, just put them in a theme park so anybody who wants to look at them can go and look at them?
I think you are not suppressing them by putting them in a museum or indeed a theme park. I kind of almost think they should be on a carousel, around Oxford in particular, where you just have to keep turning them round over and over until you begin to get something that looks like a contemporary mix of what we value. So, you know, there should be more women statues, there should be statues of people of colour, there should be statues of peacemakers as well as war makers. And keep the war heroes if you need to. But just keep it moving.
Because there was an element of this, I guess, with what was done with the empty plinth in Trafalgar Square for a while, where they sort of like rotated different things on and off it, including at one point members of the public who were allowed to go up and have a turn for an hour
and
or so.
And a huge, giant blue thumb. Let them go. But also, statues, the thing is about statues, and I haven't actually seen these two, I've just read about them, they're usually quite boring as well, visually quite dull. And it would really liven up our cityscapes if, in fact, we could put some interesting new people on them.
Okay, well, finally tonight, on an almost related note, in fact, to Sweden, specifically to the city of Gävle, where the famous local municipal Christmas decoration, a giant straw goat, seems poised to defy the form of recent years and make it all the way to Christmas Day without being destroyed. Over the last several decades, the setting fire of the goat by some or other ne'er-do-well has become traditional, the more so as the goat's fame has been amplified by social media. It has now been torched 30 times since 1966, and otherwise dismantled on several other occasions. Last year, it was burnt down the same day it was unveiled. A hastily assembled smaller goat was subsequently run over. Now, as we go to air at 18:25 London time, December 21st, it is still standing. I will confess, I'm a big fan of the Gävle goat. It's my single favourite thing about Christmas. Should we be disappointed that it has made it this far?
Well, I think that by talking about this and encouraging people to know about it, we are perhaps altering the story.
I'm going to step outside the usual bounds of broadcasting decorum, where, of course, we would say we would not by any means encourage any listeners to commit arson. I am totally encouraging any listeners in the vicinity of the Gävle goat to commit arson. You go with my blessing. Are we happy it's still standing?
Yes and no. I mean, you've got two conflicts here. You've got the hope of the local community that it's going to last versus the other bit of human nature, which is the desire to destroy. And I love the fact it's basically become a competition. People are kind of flocking from all over the country to try and have a go at this poor goat.
Over the world at this rate.
Probably the whole world.
There have been foreign attempts on the goat.
And it becomes more interesting, you know, what do? Do you start sort of, you know, launching, you know, fire missiles
that's
in
been
its
tried.
Direction?
Mm-hmm. That has been tried. In 2005, men dressed up as Santa Claus and gingerbread men launched flaming arrows at it.
And did they succeed?
To an extent, I believe, yes.
Well, it's ingenuity. We've got to find a way to get past the security cameras and get this goat. It should be a TV program, surely.
I'm amazed it hasn't been. And I have
coming soon.
Well, I have pitched it here as a magazine article several times. The idea that we do a story not merely on the goat, but we actually make our own attempt to travel to Gävle and set fire to it ourselves, thereby creating the story. I think that would be an award winner. I do commend our listeners to its Wikipedia page, in which somebody has meticulously updated year by year what has happened, you know, whether it survived and what brought it down. It's not always burned. There was one year it was kicked to pieces, which must have taken considerable effort. I like to imagine the people who did the kicking kept like yelling at the one guy who'd forgotten to bring the lighter. It's like, you know, you had one job.
I also like the idea that they're absolutely, you know, wildly drunk at this point in time. I mean, there must be gangs of men who've been drinking beer and vodka all night who have literally set their intention for 2 o'clock in the morning. And they may well meet another gang who's set on exactly the same intention. And, you know, glory has to be taken by one of them.
Has it become, though, James, because like everything that becomes a social media thing, it does now have this kind of meta aspect. Is it still an authentic folks tradition? I mean, obviously, in the 1960s, when people started setting fire to the goat, that was a sort of like a real local specific celebration of Christmas. Has it become devalued?
Well, I think clearly what we're seeing is the internationalisation of this local tradition, frankly. You know, we're sitting here in London, you know, there's a good Australian presenting this. He seems very, very interested in this, I have to say. I honestly think that the authorities should be on the lookout for an Australian of a certain age in a paisley shirt, quite frankly, who seems to have very warm intentions towards his goats. And if he has lighter fluid on it, then that clearly is going to be a tell, I think.
I mean, is it the kind of thing that could spread? Should we all be building enormous straw goats and setting
fire to
them?
We're all going to start kicking apart our Christmas trees at some point in time, going into the neighbours' yards and ripping down the fairy lights. I mean, it would certainly, all the schmaltz that's around Christmas, it would certainly liven things up a little bit.
Do either of you plan to destroy anything for Christmas?
I haven't done it this year, but last year I actually cut down a small tree in order to have my own tree, and actually the act of axing it was great fun.
James, any arson planned between now and Christmas Day?
And of course, I really wouldn't want to comment live on air, quite frankly, if that was going to happen.
Very wise, I'm sure. And that does bring us to the end of today's show. Joy Lodico and James Boyes, thank you for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Tom Edwards. There's more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.